Well, I appreciate you inviting me to this. I grew up in Conservative Mennonite Conference. We were an outreach church up in Dowagiac, Michigan. I was born in Belleville. My dad was a teacher at Belleville Mennonite, and we moved to Dowagiac, Michigan, just north of here. It was an outreach church from Town Line Mennonite Church. So I grew up in the Conservative Conference, and been to Rosedale. My brother went there. I didn't attend there, but went to a conference there. Had a good time. So very familiar. I'm sure I could make connections with every single one of you if we played the Mennonite game for more than a couple minutes. So yeah, well, I'll get into my story here. I called it an entrepreneurial life. I really am an entrepreneur, and I kind of got sidetracked a little bit and thought maybe I was a CEO, and there's a bit of a difference there. I'll get into that. And I sort of subtitled this Heading into the Unknown. Those of you that are entrepreneurs, there's a lot of unknowns when you're doing startups. So I kind of added that to it. So this is, I grew up in a family of four boys. This is us today. This was us back then, and I kind of cut my oldest brother's head off there. I didn't mean to do that, but my grandparents to the right there, all my cousins. Grandfather was Floyd Brenneman, grandmother Catherine. I'm sure some of you know them or knew them. Our life revolved around the church. We were there for the church. We were at church two or three times a week, every week. My grandfather was the pastor, then my father became the pastor, and that was our community. We were outside of a Mennonite community, but we made a great community there, and just wouldn't trade it for anything. We didn't have a lot in terms of money. Consider myself by income standards, I sort of grew up poor. And we'll talk about that a little bit later too. So this is my family, my wife. I met her at Eastern Mennonite, and my two sons who graduated from there and live in Harrisonburg. I'm getting on a plane here in a couple hours and headed there as well. And my daughter is here at Goshen College, and this was at my oldest son's wedding. So they are doing well, thriving, and love our kids and family. So after college, my wife and I moved back here. I knew there was a lot going on in the job market, didn't really know what I'd do. I graduated with a business degree and bopped around a little bit, ended up doing some purchasing for a cargo trailer manufacturing company in Bristol. That was a hot market. Things were going well, and I did all the buying of materials, and I learned a lot about the company. And I thought that I was going to get to move up in that company and be a part of things, but it really didn't work out that way. The family, it was a family business, and if I wasn't part of the family, I really wasn't going to be part of the business. And I was learning, and I was starting to really get my feet under me and understanding business concepts and things like that. And a couple of guys that owned an aluminum company that sold material to us, and I bought the material from, they saw something in me. They said, you know, if you get frustrated enough, we'd be interested in backing you financially. Well, I didn't have any money. I had college debt, and I thought, well, okay. I hadn't really thought of that yet. I was 26 years old, but I think I could do it. You know, you're kind of naive. You just jump in. So we decided to do trailers together. They had an aluminum supply business. They supplied extrusion and aluminum painted sheet for the cargo business, the trailer business. And they said, we've got most of the materials, we'll supply those to you. All you need to do is buy axles and tires and hitches and hire some people and start welding trailers together. There was this hot market for all aluminum snowmobile trailers. Car haulers were all made out of steel and steel frames, aluminum painted sheet, but steel on the skeleton. But the snowmobile trailers were aluminum because they were taking them north and they were on the salt roads and things like that. So I said, okay, great. It's better than what I'm doing now. they backed me, and we rented this little tiny building in Elkhart, and that's where we built our first trailers. And you always hear about this Elkhart story of starting in a garage. That's kind of what we did. The nice thing about doing trailers is you didn't need a lot of money to get started. You needed a chop saw, a table saw, a welder, and some screw guns. That's all you need, and the material, and that was getting supplied to me. So we started off and got going with snowmobile trailers, but pretty quickly I said, you know, all the benefits of aluminum frames, they should apply on car haulers too, and car haulers were a much larger market. Much larger than snowmobile trailers, and lasted the whole year. Snowmobile trailers ended, the market was about 6 months long. So this was our first car hauler, and I went out to the dealers. I was all excited and said, hey, dealers, we've got this new product. Now, Featherlight in Iowa was building cars, but they were $12,000, and a Hallmark with steel frame was like $5,000. That was just too big a jump for everybody. So I created one, and I did the bill of material, and it looked like it was about $750 more in cost. And I thought, oh my goodness, who wouldn't want an aluminum frame trailer over a steel frame trailer for $1,500 more? This is a no-brainer. And went out to our dealers, and they said, no, too expensive. Nobody around here wants it. No, everybody, all they care about is price. Maybe where you're from, you know, whatever, you know. And so we thought, well, that doesn't make sense. And I wasn't willing to agree to that. So we got a website. This is 2000, the year 2000. We were probably the first trailer company that had a website. We were nobody, but we could put a website out there and make it look like we were somebody. And we got hooked up with Yahoo and MSN Search. There was no Google yet. So those two search engines supplied us all the contacts we needed. And we sold direct because our dealers thought that there was no market for it. So we sold direct. People would wire us $10,000 after a 15-minute phone call. And it was like, yeah, customers really do want our product. We proved that there was a market there. Then we went back to our dealers, and they started buying from us. So that's kind of how we got started. As I was starting the aluminum trailer company, I met an Amish guy in Napanee that was building doors for our trailers, and got to know him. He needed to get rid of his door business, and he couldn't really move it into a modern building, but his neighbors were mad at him because he was outgrowing his farm. He needed to move quickly, and I said, well, I don't have any money, but I could help you run it and pay you back with the profits. So we agreed. He and I went in on this building. We got an SBA loan. We paid $500,000 for a 88,000 square foot building, which was a good deal for us, right in the middle of Napanee. And so for the first 6 years, we shared this facility, ATC on one side, Napanee Window on the other. And I was the common owner between the two. I brought in my brothers to Napanee Window, had some partners at ATC, and we made it work, and we grew very quickly. We got into some really nice trailers, and we realized that I had some guys from the local motorhome manufacturer, Newmar, join me. They were tired of motorhomes, and they wanted to do something else, so they joined me, and with them came all their brothers and cousins and uncles, and all of a sudden, we had 70 Amish guys out in the plant building amazing products, beautiful stuff. We would have people call us and say, I got this really weird idea, and we hired some engineers, we used CAD, and we got it close enough that we threw it out to the plant, and it would come off the end of the line just looking amazing. And that put us on the map. We actually created the market for aluminum trailers. We spanned that gap between that $5,000 and $12,000, and now we sell $50,000 car haulers all day long. It's absolutely amazing. But with what pickup trucks cost today, it's, you know, you can picture it a little bit better. Back when I started, I think pickup trucks were $25,000. So yeah, people have no problem dropping $50,000 on a nice car hauler like this. We build a lot of those. And this, the one to the right, is a stacker. So you drive a car in, lift it up hydraulically, drive another one underneath it, and you can carry two cars on top of each other if you have a Prevost or a 40-foot motor coach or a toter home, things like that. You can carry two cars to the track. So we build a lot of that stuff. We do high-end commercial stuff like this. We do $500,000 government projects. Stuff like this is really difficult, but again, with our workforce and engineering capability, we just built the capability over the years to do this. So that's the stuff we got into. That took about 8 or 9 years to really get going. This is a picture of me that I kind of a spread that I did for Inc. magazine. We were one of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. I think 500 fastest. I think we were like number 127 or something like that. At Napanee Windows. So I was running the door and window business. Other people were running the trailer business. So we built motorhome doors, we built travel trailer doors, and we grew really quickly. Both businesses grew really, really quickly. We sort of followed the RV market as it went up after 9/11. People didn't want to travel overseas. They bought motorhomes or travel trailers instead. And we got into travel trailer doors. The previous owner had not. So I diversified into that and we just started growing like crazy. So this was Napanee Window. We moved out into a brand new facility. We had a plant in Southern California supplying that RV industry there. We had a plant in Idaho. We had two plants in Napanee. And we put an aluminum extrusion plant in Goshen. And this aluminum extrusion plant, we were using extrusion for our doors and trailers. And we thought, let's just supply ourselves. We didn't like the supply we were getting from suppliers. And so we bought a $7 million extrusion press and put it in Goshen here. And that was part of the Napanee Window company. And Jeremy did the sales for the extrusion company. That was his first real job, and he was in charge of sales. So I'll explain what happened in a second. So you do need sales to pay for a $7 million piece of equipment. So things were going really, really well. And I thought I was really smart. And I was a humble Mennonite, yes, but, you know, way back in the back of my mind, I'm kind of like, man, I am really good at this. Like, I just have a knack. And when people would come to me and say, I don't think we're doing this well, or I don't think we're good at this, I'd be like, come on. I mean, look at us. You know, we're successful. Then, so this is 2007. We have five plants. We did $40 million in sales in 2007. So from 1999, when I started, to 2007, 1999 we did, or 2000, we did $2 million in sales. 2007, we did $40 million in sales. We grew really quickly. And things were going really well. But what happened in 2008? Everybody knows. If you're older than probably that table down there doesn't know. But so this is what happened. You can see the trajectory that we were on. We were following the market up. And all of a sudden in 2008, the market went from 353,000 RVs to 237,000 RVs to 165,000 RVs. And that was just after we got the aluminum plant going, four plants building doors nationwide, and our core business just basically stopped. I mean, in June of 2008 to August of 2008, there really wasn't much activity here in Elkhart County. And that was when we needed it the most. Like, we had just made these large investments. So that was really painful. The bank came in, said, I don't think you're going to make it. This is in April of 2008, I got to meet my workout banker. And those of you that have ever met a workout banker, you know what that is. And it strikes fear into your heart because you don't get the banker that's the sales guy anymore. Workout guy. And the workout banker, their whole goal is to get you out of the bank as quickly as possible and to save as many losses as possible. So that was a bad time for us. And we lost that business. That's a picture of the empty plant to the left. I just stopped in midstream and it got auctioned off. And my brothers were involved in that business. It was really difficult. Said goodbye to 200 really great employees along with their families. It was really, really hard. You know, this is a verse that for me during that time, this is a verse I just kept reading over and over. You know, you have to remind yourself that, okay, I can get through this because this is really what matters. You have to just keep coming back to what matters. My kids are healthy. I have another business. I have ATC, and that business is going to make it through. But it's just, you know, neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor powers nor things present nor things to come nor height nor depth nor any creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And I remember standing up at the church we attend in Elkhart, Belmont Mennonite. I remember standing there getting ready to sing this, one of my favorite songs, through our fragmentary prayers. And I got up and I went to say the first word. I could not sing. I just stopped and I just closed my eyes and just let everyone sing around me. And it was just, and still to this day, I can't sing that song. It just sticks with you. So that's what we were going through. Lost a lot. We had signed personal guarantees with the bank, so we had to pay those, which we did over the next 5 years somehow. But it was a really difficult time. So the turning point, we had a little classy motorhome. We took the kids out of school at the beginning of 2009, and we headed west. And I picked up this book. We had sort of done some lean stuff out on the factory floor, some moving tables together, eliminating waste. But I thought, as the CEO, it has nothing to do with me. That's just the operations team trying to save money. I heard that's a cool thing, something about Toyota. And I realized, I picked up this book and I realized, oh my goodness, this could have saved us. I mean, if we'd have done this, you know, we paid piece rate. We just sort of put the schedule out there and let our talented workforce do it however they wanted. If they wanted a messy plant, that's fine. They're on piece rate. If they wanted to walk a long way to get materials, it's fine. They're on piece rate. And we had incredible people, you know, sort of like Jim Collins' book, Good to Great. Put great people in a room, have great products, great customers, and become an amazing business. And Toyota said, not quite. You got to have incredible processes as well. You got to put as much into processes as you do people. So I read that book and it changed how I looked at things. So after we got back from out west, I joined ATC, and it was being run by a guy that was a finance guy, and he was pinching pennies, and he got us through that time. Amazing. I couldn't have done what he did. So I joined and just said, I'm going to start doing some of this lean stuff. So this is something we did that I like pictures of lean because it's hard to explain. This has to do with improving our flow. The diagram to the left, you remember the building I showed you, that's here. It's all cut up. It's terrible. But we had another plant over here. The steel frames would come in here, enter the building here. The aluminum frame shop was here. We'd go outside all the way around and then finish down here. And we just said, flow needs to be a lot better. So in a 6-month period, we moved, we changed, we closed down parts of the building, we closed down the second plant, and in September of 2009, that was the flow. You don't have to be a lean guru. You don't have to know anything about process to know which one is going to be less costly and provide better quality products. So then we attacked the plant. How are we going to clean up this mess? So the picture to the left is what it looked like when we were on piece rate and said, you guys can do whatever you want. However you want to do it, That's fine. We think it should be cleaner, but if you don't want to do it that way. The one on the right was after about 3 years of a lot of hard work. You don't just make a change like that, sweeping and cleaning and painting the floor. That is a cultural shift. And that took 3 years of hard work and some people leaving that didn't want to be told what to do. So I was, the thing about lean is most transformations stall when you start slaughtering sacred cows in sales, in accounting, you know, the places you're not allowed to go with lean. Certain things you're not allowed to touch. But as the CEO founder, I was now driving it, and I was driving the lean change. We went fast. We went way too fast. It was hard for people to keep up with me. But remember, I had gone through that really devastating loss, and after reading that book, I knew that it could have saved us. That wasn't the only thing, but I wasn't in the mood to compromise. So I was a bit of a tyrant, but just simple 5 S's. And we had a consultant that helped us. The one to the left, it's probably not a fair picture because the maintenance room to the left hadn't been used in a while. So I kind of took the worst possible picture and then took after about 4 years of culture transformation. And really, it's simple. The tools you touch every day, keep those right in front of you. Everything else needs to go in an organized fashion into cabinets. But those are the tools that our maintenance team touched every day. And they were labeled, and if someone borrowed it, you knew exactly where to put it back. That was a transformation as well. Materials. So the common thing in this area with materials is the line workers manage their own materials. So the picture to the left is the line worker's idea of how to keep all the parts and pieces on the line side, stocked line side. And if you need something, go tell the purchasing manager, purchasing person, you need more of something. Well, think about creating value for the customer. I got my head down, I'm trying to do this thing, and then I go over and I got to manage my own inventory. How good do you think the line guys are at managing inventory? Terrible, awful. So why would we have them do that? So we created this offline team that started thinking about how do we provide only what is needed, when it's needed, in small quantities. And it took, seems simple now, but we created these 2-bin Kanban carts to the right, and everything that position on the factory floor needed was in those 2 carts and 2 bins. So you use up what's in the front bin, put it on top. You can see the empty bins on top. That creates a signal for the team to come around, pick up all the empties, put the full ones back, and every single cart got touched twice a day. So you really only need 4 hours of inventory in that front bin. We got really good at that. And our inventory, our raw material inventory turns went from about 5, because we said, well, we're custom, you know, 5 turns a year is pretty good, right? We got up to about 18 turns and used that cash to pay off all our debt because we didn't have to keep it in inventory. So it's like, I mean, operational improvements like this one is like a loan that you get, you take, but you never have to pay it back because you do it with it, operational improvements. So, and then today it just keeps getting better and better. Now we use vendor managed, and our vendor comes in and restocks those Kanban bins for us. And then we sort of plateaued after we cleaned things up and really did a lot of improvement work on our internal processes. We sort of plateaued and we said, how can we make this better? So we had 3 production lines in the factory. To the right, you'll see the production lines. We had our simple cargo trailer line. We had our medium car hauler semi-custom line. And then we had our heavy hitters on the last line, the really big custom stuff. And that was in the plant. But in the office, we still had our engineering department, sales department, the departments were you know, on their own, and purchasing and materials was on their own, and they talk about how the salespeople say yes to everything, and the engineers are always grumpy, and they never want to do any work, and you're talking about the different departments. I said, all right, enough of that. we divided up those departments to align with each production line. So what you see on the left is the team that handled the midline, the value stream two. And every person that it required to go from a quote at the dealer to a ready to build trailer information-wise, the folder that went out to the line, everything it took to do that process was in that one room. And it basically, the folders were, each one represented a trailer and it moved around the wall as it got closer and ready. And we could just watch the information flow. It was in the computer, but we pulled it out, made it physical, and watched it flow. We probably have done 50 tours around this idea, and we call it value stream management. We're gonna take the office work and we're gonna align it with what happens out on the floor. So does it work? This is a question I'd always get. Lean, I've heard all about it, but people have tried it and it just doesn't really work. And so I put this together just to kind of give you an idea. So this is a $100,000 custom trailer. The one you see there is about $100,000. It takes a lot to get that trailer ready to build and then build. So before Lean, it would have taken us 60 days from a quote at the dealer to delivered. It would have taken us about 60 days, about 1,350 people hours, all different people, to produce that. And the warranty after the sales would have been about 4% of that $100,000. After we went through this transformation, it took 60 days from quote ready to build in the plant. That didn't include the physical build. We went to 10 days quote to ready to build. Total people hours were 900, and warranty after the sale was down to 1.2%. So after about 8 years of really hard work, that's about where we got to. Okay, so I'm a fanatic, and the reason I show you this picture is when I was speaking at Lean conferences like that, I shared this one time and everybody always wanted to hear about it. So when I was going through this transformation at my company, my kids were young. We had three of our own, and then we had a Korean exchange student that lived with us for 4 years. And I would just get so frustrated they wouldn't do their dishes. You know, they'd have breakfast and they'd run off to school and there's this giant pile of dishes on the counter or on the table or whatever. And so I kept, guys, do your dishes, do your dishes, do your dishes. So some friends and I got this idea, and we bought Fiesta ware, and each kid had a color. Each family member had a color. So you see the colors there. There's red, and they red glass, silverware, everything they needed to eat their meal, we had. I had green. I can still name all the colors. My wife had yellow. So if a dish didn't get done, you knew exactly who it was. And what we do is we just set it off to the side, let it dry and get really crusty, you know, and the next time we go to sit down for our meal, they'd go and they'd look in the drawer and it isn't there and it's over there and they gotta scrub it or it's down in the movie room and hey, you know, it's up to you. So that worked amazingly and we don't do it anymore because our kids are grown up, but boy, did that help a lot. So I'm going to hit my timer here. It looks like I got 15 minutes. So things were going really great. We built a new facility for ATC. We had open offices. We had an amazing process to do that. And really, really had things going well. And I did a life plan. Life plan is something by the Patterson Institute. I met with a counselor for 2 days. And they basically open up your life and you walk through all the things that got you to here. What shaped you? What were some of the turning points in your life? And you discover who you are and what you want to be when you grow up. And I did this in 2017. And it was really great. And it really came down to a couple of things. He didn't like that I was in a CEO role where I was driving this improvement and operational excellence and had to be very disciplined because he knew from my story that I was really an entrepreneur. I wasn't really a CEO. And I said, I gotta stay in it. No, I'm doing just fine. Don't worry about me. And I had started drinking too much alcohol. It started off, you know, with social drinking, and I didn't grow up drinking, but I didn't drink in college. But sort of over time, you know, it was sort of this thing we did with friends. But I did not deal with the trauma of being a business. And my counselor helped me unpack all this. This is how I know it. But I left that life plan, and he said, get in a creative role. You have to be creative. That's part of who you are and brings you joy. You cannot keep your head down in the CEO role. Okay, yeah. And figure out what your relationship is with alcohol. Okay, yeah. And I didn't do that. So I kept going. And, you know, I would say the entrepreneur's dilemma is you just get in this mode to make it through some of the things you go through as an entrepreneur. You get in this mode where you just don't listen and become hardened. You keep moving forward. I mean, you've heard it, you know, just keep moving forward. Don't look back. And this was one of my favorite sayings when I was starting up, you know, keep your face to the sunshine and you cannot see the shadows. And that's great. But you also need to look back and dig up some of that stuff and deal with it. Because if you don't, it's going to come out someday in the wrong way. And you're going to deal with it in a lot worse way. And in late 2018, I started dealing with that in a bad way. My wife kept talking to me about, hey, I think you have an issue. We need to deal with it. And by late 2018, I left ATC. I had to. And it was really hard because I'd worked really hard to make this incredibly successful company. But it was time for me to take a break. And I took a break for 3 years. I didn't do a lot. I worked with some nonprofits. I retained my ownership at ATC and board seat, and still was allowed to or able to enjoy that work. But it could have been a lot easier, better transition had I listened to folks that were telling me to be careful. I took time to understand what had gone on in me, dealt with the trauma that I hadn't dealt with before, read a bunch of books, met with my counselor regularly, every 2 weeks, just dig this stuff up, deal with it, focus on it. What are we doing? Traveled a lot with my wife, was really great. So it was a great blessing. I didn't have to worry about money, so that part was nice. But I also got to start planning my second phase, my entrepreneurial, nurture that entrepreneurial spirit, which is how I was built. It's what brings me joy. And as soon as I went back to that and really dealt with some of those things, I didn't struggle with alcohol anymore. So I started two new businesses. The Aluminum Insights, I went back to what I had done before, the business I had lost, and sort of recreated that. I had some financial information, created the plan, invited two of my friends in from the Mennonite community, one to run it as CEO and another one CFO, and I do all the sales. So my trailer company uses about 6 million pounds of this stuff, and so we had a good key customer to get started with. It's a very industrial process, that's what the extrusion looks like on a trailer frame once it's all put together. So you can see we use a lot of it. So in 2020, we took off for Italy. That's where a lot of this equipment is made. We went to look at some equipment. You can see some of those pictures. The equipment is very, very large. So extrusion is the same as pasta, plastic. You take the material and you press it through a die, and it comes out in long shapes of whatever you have in that die. So picture a Play-Doh Fun Factory. When you're pressing it through, whatever shape you have, it comes out. That's exactly the same thing. Now, with aluminum, it takes a lot more heat and a lot more pressure. We heat the billets up to 900 degrees and put a giant press like the one you see to the right with about 2,000 tons of pressure behind it, and it comes out in long pieces. So my partners here to the bottom, that was a picture of us in Italy. We broke ground in Syracuse. There was no room in Goshen. We wanted to be in Goshen, but there was no room there, so we had to build down in Syracuse. My CEO lives on a lake there, so that worked out perfect for him. This is some pictures of the building in probably the worst weather imaginable in February and March in 2022. We were rushed to get this thing put together. The equipment was arriving. You can see me on the giant forklift there. That forklift lifts 60 tons. So it's a big piece of equipment. And you can see the main cylinder there is a very heavy piece of equipment. This is starting it up. You can see the logs there that I'm sitting on. Those are 24 foot long, solid 8 inches in diameter. And we take a chunk of that off, 47 inches up to 47 inches long, and we press that through the die. And we make tubes and window shapes and door shapes and all that kind of stuff. So that's an overview of the equipment. Equipment all came from Italy in about 65 containers and took 10 Italians, about 4 months to put it together and get it running. So expensive process. I got a little impatient over the time it was taking. So you can see here, this is the oven. The log is beginning to enter into the furnace. By the time it gets to the front, it's 1,000 degrees and this arm picks it up, puts it in this press, and then presses it through and runs it out up to 200 feet long. And then when it cools, we chop it up into whatever length the customer wants. So that's kind of the overview of what that looks like. It's a really fun business. This was our team. This was a year and a half ago, just as we were getting started. And now we run 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. We have about 70 employees. And this month we will ship about 1.5 million pounds of aluminum. It's about 2 truckloads a day. So things are going well. The difference between before is that I'm doing all the sales now instead of Jeremy. So that's why things are going much better. No, Jeremy did great. We needed a little more time anyway, and the economy didn't cooperate. So one of the things we do is we stock material in the plant. This is really rare for an extrusion mill to also stock material in the plant, but we ship to my trailer company every single day. So we have to have all their parts represented on the shelf so we can pull and ship quickly. Part of the just-in-time inventory that they do. So we set this business up to do just-in-time. And it's been very successful. We are no longer taking customers that need that because we're full. Most of our customers still, we just ship directly to them without stocking it. And then a couple of friends of mine 2 years ago invited me to join them to make boat seats. So we started a company called Crew Seating, and we make the seats in that boat to the right. That's a Bennington boat. We make the seats for that boat. It's been really fun. One of the things I love about doing startups this time around is I know what I'm doing and I know lean. And so we can build those things right into the process, both how we take care of people, our culture, all of that, plus the processes. It's been really fun. And I always say, if we have to make a transformation 5 years from now, then shame on us because we shouldn't have to do that. So we've started at a pretty high level in both of these companies. Both of the key leaders there have extensive lean experience, one of them at ATC with me, the one that runs the seating business. And we've been able to start at a really high level and we're gonna go even higher. So this is a picture of some of the factory things, some of the lean systems, Kanban and that. We're building all that in. Our metrics boards where we meet around those every day and do reflections on how we can make it better. Things like that. So that's really fun. We just opened a new facility for ATC in 2023 in June. So this is our new main facility with offices, and we sold our old facility and we were renting another facility. So now we have the new facility we built in 2017. And then this is our main facility, 230,000 square feet. So I often get a question like, picture this when you were getting started? I was like, no way. No, I thought, you know, I sort of 2 years in, I thought, yeah, this might be, we might be able to figure this out. I think I know what I'm doing. And 10 years in, I thought, you know, we had maxed out, but the market has continued to ask us to do more and more. About half of our business is now RV toy haulers. So we've entered the RV space. Ours have a garage in the back. And the difference between ours and the RV guys is it's on a car hauler frame. So you can put a Jeep, four-door Jeep Rubicon in our toy hauler. A little bit more expensive than you get from Keystone or a company like that. But it's been a successful product for us. And that gets built in this building here. So four books that I would recommend. This was a hard list for me to come up with last night. I was just thinking, man, I didn't want to overload people with too many, but Great by Choice is Jim Collins' follow-up to Good to Great. And it's more beneficial for me because he talks a lot about failure in there, bad luck. And so I would have said we had some bad luck with the timing of 2008, but there's some really great stuff in there about that. This is the productivity system that I use personally, Getting Things Done by David Allen. Fantastic method. And I've been using that for about 5 years. So zero inbox on my email, things like that. But creating a trusted system that your brain can put in those tasks and let go of so it can do the fun, creative stuff. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I mean, a lot of you probably read that. I'm reading it again, and it just blows my mind every time I read it. And The Toyota Way, classic book. There's a lot in there. So important lessons learned. Just a few things before I finish here. So something I really struggle with, are you in the right position? Should you be leading, or should you be taking a more narrow role that brings you joy? Around some of the things that Jeremy talked about. That's something I continue to ask myself and still do today. Both of my business startups, I brought in a CEO as a partner from day one. I did not want to run the business. Find a good counselor that can challenge you. I think I heard someone is a counselor. You're a counselor, right? A therapist, was I? Oh, you, yeah. I'm sure you can vouch for this. Find a good counselor, because when you reach some success, sometimes people are afraid to approach you and tell you, you're really missing it on this, or you're dangerous in this area. And they're not just going to walk up to you and do that, but you're paying a counselor to tell you some of those things. And I wish that all the way through I would have had a strong counselor relationship. I do now. This is an interesting one. So this is out of the Toyota Way book. This has to do with comparing Japanese leaders in a lot of companies to some American charismatic leaders like Elon Musk. The moment a leader allows himself to become the primary reality people worry about, rather than the reality being the primary reality, you have a recipe for mediocrity or worse. This is one of the reasons why less charismatic leaders often produce better long-term results. I can be a little bit charismatic, and if my people around me are having to craft the message or only tell me certain things or not completely truthful, that's my fault as a leader, because that's what I'm having them do. And so you think of Elon Musk. There's a lot of people around Elon Musk that can't be truthful with him. And they're not managing to reality, they're managing to Elon Musk's reality. So something to remember as you start experiencing some success. And part of a strong faith community, I mean, I don't know how people go through business careers and life without being part of a strong faith community. I mean, we just relied on our faith community time and time and time again. Pastors and small group cohorts and things like that. I just don't know how people function without it. And every Sunday morning, back in that pew, singing those songs, and being affirmed. And it just, it was like, I just don't know how people do without that. And so one of my favorite sayings, and this has to do with entering into the unknown. I quote this to people a lot. Henry Nouwen is one of the wisest people that I know of. Died of cancer in the mid-90s. He was a Catholic priest. He said, "The art of living is to enjoy what we can see and not complain about what remains in the dark. When we are able to take the next step with the trust that we will have enough light for the next step, the step that follows, we can walk through life with joy and be surprised at how far we go." So that's hard for us. But let's rejoice in the little light we carry and not ask for the great beam that would take all shadows away. And that has been a part of my life for a long time. And we want to know things. We want to see every step along the way. And sometimes we can. Sometimes we have a lot of light. But there's times where we only have enough light as we're taking that next step. And that's something that it's hard for us. It's part of being human. It's part of our relationship with God. This is my email, my phone number. If you want to connect with me, if you have questions about Lean, if you have questions about anything, reach out. Love to talk with some of you more. Thank you.